Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to this last session of a glorious day of Open Tech. Love it. Love Open Tech. Wonderful.
Hmm? Your computer.
My computer might run out of battery, but probably will be fine for the duration. So 31% is totally fine. Brilliant. Okay, so I am Ira, Irina Brzezewski, Shevsky on the Twitters, and I'm here to talk about games. So I play a lot of board games. Love board games. I took this photo this morning of my current board game collection. There are more in a separate room, like where they're sort of unfavorite board games. These are my sort of choice set for now. And, you know, we all like games. Games are really cool. And, of course, all games are valid, but some are kind of more valid than others. Like, I am quite opinionated about the games that I play. I definitely have some preferences. And that's kind of what I'm going to talk about today. Those preferences and why I have them and how that shapes, obviously, my and hopefully your worldview in 20 minutes' time. So some of the important dynamics and things that I really care about are simplicity, complexity, novelty, who doesn't like new stuff, right? The limited effect of kind of chance, because you don't really want to leave too much to chance. Fairness, evolution. Now, simplicity and complexity sound like diametrically opposed things. They're definitely not. Simplicity is important when it comes to rules, when it comes to understanding how to play. And this is about participation. If you don't know the rules, if they're just too hard, then you can't get involved. Like, being able to easily pick up the rules of the system that you exist in is actually really important in terms of being part of the process. So I have a little picture of Go, because it is actually quite simple in terms of rules. All you need to do is use your colour of stone and place it in an empty cross section which is not surrounded by the other person's colour. That is basically it. Those are the rules. Complexity is fundamental to good gameplay because it's about how much space there is for choice, for decision making. So tic-tac-toe is a really bad example because there are just a set number of different states that are possible, and your ability to influence and choose what you do is actually quite limited. So if you play a game where at any given go, any given dice roll, the best, most advantageous move is completely transparent and obvious, that's not really that much fun. You're basically just going through the motions. Being able to have a variety of different winning strategies and thinking about what might be the best one and responding to what other people are doing and what strategies they're choosing is, I think, a really important part of interesting gameplay. It needs to be challenging, it needs to be strategic. So people call this sort of strategic gameplay in many ways. So novelty, and I think a lot of games are basically chance-based or random-based or novel-based, and we all believe that variety is quite important, obviously. You know, you don't want to buy a game only to be able to play it once, and then that's it, really, it's all over. And there's no kind of replayability, there's no intrigue or variety that exists. One of my favourite games, Dominion, involves lots of different possible cards which have sort of secondary rules on each card, and the 10 that you choose essentially affect the decisions that you make and the different strategies that exist in that game. And most games will have some element of chance because people have kind of clocked onto this a while ago. So any games we have to sort of shuffle the order of events that come up or anything else will have variety. Games where you roll dice to choose where you actually step or go, what things come up. I think in my picture, one of the key games is a kind of dice rolling game, and that's just pretty good. But too much dice, too much randomness can be bad. I think we all know that if everything is up to chance, if everything is up to luck, then we lose our sense of control and we lose our sense of autonomy and us being part of the process. We end up kind of playing games that are essentially based on hope. Sort of, if I happen to roll the right number, if I happen to get the right thing, that's going to be where I win. And I would say Monopoly is one of those games. If you happen to land on some of the kind of cheaper bits of real estate, if you happen to get a block of real estate, you will quickly find that you are in a much more advantageous position if you aren't so lucky, and less of it is about strategy. The next thing I really want to talk about is fairness. Fairness, like, what does that mean in terms of games? I think it's about how games feel, your experience of playing them. We're social creatures, and I think we often have quite a sharp sense of fairness and justice. And there are lots of different dynamics that feed into this. Obviously, we have cooperative games where we're actually, you know, we're not competing. It's all kind of, we're all friends. It's all nice. We get to agree the strategy together. We're all involved. No one gets left out. And that's really nice. But it's also less competitive and maybe less fun. And I'm personally sort of, I'm like, you know, take care, we'll take. Fine. We've got games which have zero-sum mechanics where actually, in order for me to do better, I take away from you. Monopoly is also a really good example of a zero-sum game. You know, when you land on my property, I take your money, not the bank's money. And in order for me to do well, you kind of get to do badly. And then there are games with lots of different feedback loops. Once you have a certain kind of mechanism in play, it gets stronger and stronger. And there are a variety of those. And one thing I really wanted to kind of get to... in this talk, which might be a recurring theme, is that Monopoly really, really sucks. Like, it's just such a bad game. I really sometimes am just in shock at how much of, like, the kind of different mechanics that exist are just really poor. I've already mentioned that it's quite sort of chance-based. It's zero-sum. It really lacks that kind of strategic complexity. It's not like there are a variety of different mechanisms to win. Like, there's a bit of choice, but it's basically buy and own all the stuff, and then you're fine. The kind of, the curve is one of those traditional, like, hockey stick sort of things. It's like, once you're kind of doing pretty well, that's it. You've won. And I remember playing, and, you know, in games, in board game circles, we talk about early game, mid game, end game, right? There's no mid game and end game in Monopoly. There is the early game, the people who lucked out and bought the right stuff, and then the other people who mid game and end game sat there sulking, slowly building up resentment towards the other player until you basically are no longer on speaking terms. And what I'm here to talk about, really, is that alternatives do exist. You know, I think we've kind of, as a community maybe, we've decided that really this is just the way things are. But you know what? In board games, these things, this shit, totally, are literally real printed games. I took pictures of these earlier. They are legitimate objects you could own too. And I kind of picked out these two. I mean, I think there's a lot of board games that were kind of in my original list that I would refer you to. I think I tweeted a picture of it earlier. But I wanted to pick these two up because they have kind of interesting mechanics. So Suburbia is a game that has this rebalancing mechanism where this is the kind of, these are the points, right? And ultimately you win by points. And as you get further ahead, every time you kind of move past a red block, you automatically lose your kind of per game income and reputation thing. So it just gets a little bit harder. You sort of slow down as you know, instead of that hockey stick move of as soon as I get hit, I'm really off, and there's a kind of exponential growth. It actually gets a bit harder towards the end. So there's a kind of more even playing field. Power grid has also a rebalancing mechanism that's a bit controversial, because how, you know, is it good, is it bad? But essentially the person most furthest behind gets to go first in the next go, and they get to kind of bid on things first. And power grid is actually really fascinating in lots of different ways, because there's a lot of cool bidding mechanisms where you're essentially running you're competing energy companies within a country. So this is Germany. And what you're doing is you're sort of choosing whether to invest in coal, in oil, in renewable energies and other things. And actually, the non-renewable goods run out depending on who else is playing with them. So the more the other players are choosing coal, the less advantageous it becomes for you to invest in a coal plant, essentially, because things get more expensive as people buy them and use them. Now, the last thing I want to talk, the last kind of type of game I really also want to mention are evolving games. So this is kind of quite a new thing, but super exciting. For you, for those of you who haven't played the Legacy kind of versions, Pandemic Legacy is fantastic. Spoiler alert, there are zombies at some point. And it's a game where essentially your choices have some kind of consequences. So as you play the different turns, the gameplay evolves, and there's a kind of complexity about it and a choice and sort of real, a feeling of the way that we play the game, the choices that we make, the losses or the winnings that create will have consequences further down the line. So that's great, board games, we all love board games. Why else are you here? But what does that mean for us? What does that mean about life? Like, what, you know, who cares? And what I want to say is I think that in our society, in our culture, in our existence, these kind of rules and systems have a huge influence on how we behave, on the choices that we make, on the options that we see, on the things that we prioritize, and the way that we interact, and the role that technology plays. I know it's been said, but technology is political. The architectures that exist are political. And events have consequences. Sad but true. So we have our own monopolies. I was going to come back to this always. But we live in a world where monopolies are the most effective mechanism, the mechanism, the way the kind of the corporations that really outcompete everyone else. And one of the reasons they might outcompete everyone else is partly because they're centralized, partly because also they're data driven. I mean, if you think about it, at some point in time, there was this expectation that digital services are kind of free, and advertisements became one of the most effective business models, because, you know, how can you compete with free? Free is great, right? Love free. The downside of that is, in order to kind of own the advertising market, you really want to have all the people, because having all the people gives you all the data, and having all the data means you have really good profiles on people. You can really customize those advertisements. You know, often Google, Facebook, I mean, I don't know because I don't work there, but they might have a really good insight about if you're feeling particularly insecure one day and that you really need to see that advert about buying, you know, a better fitness class or a fitness app or a spa day or some kind of other self-help thing. But also, I guess some of it is useful. But the fundamental thing that happens is these centralized systems operate in this kind of zero-sum game mechanic. The winner takes all. Centralized systems basically will quickly outcompete and take over other potential competitors in the market, and there is just not room for them. We also see this kind of increasing rise in gatekeepers and walled gardens. You know, Amazon, Facebook. Essentially, Oh, no. It's not done. Essentially, Amazon has done a really great job with being cheaper and being really convenient and wonderful. And, as soon as you complain, they just say, sure, we'll just refund it. It's all not a problem. But they really centralize the kind of user experience. They end up being the point of entry that everyone else goes through. So now, if you're a small business, I mean, you're really disincentivized to start your own shop or your own marketplace. You need to be on Amazon. You need to be on the Amazon marketplace. Same with Facebook. Lots of games are now in Facebook. Often people literally live within Facebook. They see all their news within Facebook. And it's a huge kind of central bit of control. But also, obviously, these gatekeepers have increasing data on our activities. I think this kind of really sucks in many ways. It really limits our level of choice and our autonomy. So, when I kind of started, I said, I think some games are good, some games are bad. Like, here are some of the things that I care about. Some of the things that I care about when it comes to tech and systems are openness, decentralization, fairness and cooperation, privacy and autonomy. I just wanted to quickly talk a little bit about some of these things before finishing off. So, openness. So we're at Open Tech. You probably know what openness is. I come from the open data space myself. I used to work for Open Knowledge. And open data, open access, open standards, transparency, I think as John brilliantly talked in his talk earlier, really important mechanisms to safeguard certain features of, in John's case, archiving and preserving materials, but in our case, access to information. Anna also talked about the ability to map stuff and make certain things explicit when she did a talk on kind of overseas company owning parts of the UK, parts of England and Wales, really. And it's only until you kind of map that and make it really transparent how bits of your landscape are actually owned by these tax-avoiding overseas companies that people start maybe thinking about them. So openness, open kind of the ability to access research without being able to pay for it, the ability to have open data that you can connect with and learn stuff from and make judgments. Transparency of government and spending, transparency of companies, and standards that actually let you talk to each other and interoperate, a really important part of what can kind of create this sort of different mechanism, this alternative source of power to the kind of more centralized models. Redecentralized.org is a fantastic website. And resource that I obviously have absolutely nothing to do with. It's not mine. It is mine. And Francis's. Where is Francis? Can't see him, but he's over there. He's super cool. You should, if you don't know him, you should chat to him. Redecentralized was started in an attempt to bring together some of the projects, the technical projects that are looking at decentralization on a kind of technical protocol level, and create some kind of umbrella term under which people can gather and projects can kind of be discovered and found. And again, this is sort of based on some principles and values. It's around resilience. You know, if everything's central, and that means sort of, all the data is in one place, but also all the power and decision-making is in one place, it's not very resilient. You can kind of, one big flood, maybe a couple of nukes, could totally destroy your whole photo history. That would be sad. I mean, I don't know about you. I'm fairly emotionally attached to a lot of the photos that I take. And a lot of them, genuinely, are in some cloud. Privacy. Privacy, privacy is dead, according to Mark Zucky, whatever his name is, but is actually a really important part of keeping centers of power to account. you know, it's important in journalism, it's important in activists, it's important in any situation where you're challenging the status quo. And everyone has something. Everyone's like, well, I'm fine. But you've probably been in front of your laptop in compromising situations, or naked, or whatever. There's a microphone and a camera there. If you suddenly got a bit uppity, a bit slightly too many opinions, we know how to sort that out. Choice, competition, obviously this is about monopolies. You know, having alternatives, having something else to do is important. And also decent read, etc. It's all kind of about fun. And that kind of comes back to the games. When you're playing Monopoly, it's not really fun because, you know, it's a foregone conclusion. It's sort of, if you didn't luck out, that's it. What else are you going to do? You're just the sucker there making other people feel smug. And, like, what's the point? So, one thing I wanted to kind of touch on is that openness and decentralization, or really centralized, are tactics. They're not really a goal in themselves. It's not like, right, once we have some openness, we're all good. Or once we have some decentralization, that's the only thing that matters. They are kind of, they're a means to an end. And the end is about the values and the choices and those kind of principles. But both openness and decentralization are quite useful tactics that you dress up as goals because they're quite complex. As someone who came from the kind of open knowledge sort of network back in the day, back when openness was less cool, so I got on the bandwagon 6 years ago. having this umbrella term, having this concept of just like, hey, we're all about openness, or hey, we're all about decentralization, is really useful because actually people care about different things, right? People care about, and I think maybe my next slide, oh no, it doesn't, but people care about slightly different aspects. In the same ways, you know, like different board games are good at different times. Like sometimes it's nice just to roll a dice and not have that much complexity. And, you know, I might have a certain preference, but yours might be different, but it might be similar enough that we can still play together and have a nice time. So it's about kind of finding those subtle overlaps and not having complete and utter lockdown. It's about preserving the choice but creating the network. This is where my Wittgenstein reference goes in that I mentioned on Twitter. Which, tiny little aside, but later Wittgenstein, who's a wonderful, Wittgenstein is a wonderful man, Philosophical Investigations is what you should read, talks about how names and terms and meanings are kind of often follow a family resemblance. They're a network. You know, your cousin might sort of share the same shape of ear as you. So there's not kind of, you're not obviously completely related, but there's something there. In the same way, I think openness and decentralization have this sort of more of a network effect. And that's something that's important. So I wanted to kind of have one slide on practicalities. Like what can we do to further some of these goals? Well, support open standards, actually cooperate, play nicely with each other. A lot of the time, these kind of communities are really easy and eager to criticize and find fault with each other instead of promoting each other and kind of being part of a common movement. We can start pushing for opening up some of the gatekeepers, taxing closed systems, and actually starting to say, you know what, data should be separate. Data should be decoupled from software. Like, you should have data, you should choose your software. Software should be decoupled from services or hosting. There's lots of things that we can kind of start doing. So, and I didn't really talk about the other kind of principles, but that's because, like, I'm probably running out of time anyway. But openness and decentralization, and this is the summing up part of the talk. It's fundamentally a set of values that we choose. It is a set of kind of different networks and aspects that we might care about. But they're also kind of new kind of mechanisms that create an opportunity for different behavior. So the open movement has already had a huge effect, and the decentralized, so I mean, like talking more about re-decentralized is another talk which I've done and I can talk to you about later. But there is a huge amount of interesting projects, and Vinny might talk about some of it, I don't know. But there's a huge number of interesting projects and protocols that are open and decentralized and mesh networked and preserve your privacy and don't have a single point of failure and allow kind of connection between lots of different nodes and kind of emergent properties that are slightly different to just using the standard well-known mechanisms. These goals and tactics create this opportunity for alternatives. So when I was young, I actually spent hours, sometimes really if you add up to it, probably days and weeks, playing Monopoly, the board game. Partly because it was popular, and partly because there weren't many alternatives I knew about. I think the situation is very similar now. We have a lot of monopolies that exist, and I am on all the Facebooks and the Googles of, you know, everywhere. And they are popular, and the alternatives aren't really always obvious or easy to find. But actually, they do exist, and they should exist. And once we find them, then it opens up this whole beautiful new world of being different and behaving differently and interacting with other people in a different, more interesting way. When I played Monopoly, I didn't even enjoy being the person who was winning because, like, then everyone would sulk. So what I think we need to do is we need to create those clear alternatives. Remember, simplicity is important. You know, adoption is key. Being able to know how to sign on and use something is really fundamental. And it needs to be an alternative, and it needs to be different. So, good luck. Thank you very much.
Obviously, today is kind of a hot topic day for talking about that, given that a bunch of Bitcoin scammers have just taken the NHS offline. So I'm going to talk a bit about that, I'm going to talk a bit about the history of the internet, and I'm going to talk a bit about whether or not we have any reasonable expectation of a decent future for the human race. Right? So let's get cracking. So I've lived through three ages of the internet. The first stage was the Internet of Ideas. I was around at the very early stages of the web at Edinburgh University. You know, we all downloaded CERN HTTP and plugged it in and ran a little web server. It was all brand spanking new. You know, HTML before there was an image tag. The web before there were domain names. And up until probably the mid to late 1990s, all that you could really do on the internet was exchange ideas. There wasn't a bandwidth to move around music, there wasn't a bandwidth to move around film, movies. There was barely enough bandwidth to move around large corpuses of text. There was no advertising on the internet to speak of because there was no way to take money over the internet. So you could advertise for something, but nobody could pay you for it. And we lived in this extremely privileged world where almost everybody who had an internet address was part of an academic institution or a government. So you had academic privilege extended over a network of computers on which it was basically impossible to exchange money, and as a result, the entire thing was a very elevated, very rarefied kind of inhuman space. A little bit like Burning Man or Davos. And that was a very good time, right? You know, if you went onto a newsgroup and you talked to people, they were enormously well informed. Frequently, they were very, very senior in their fields. If you asked questions, you got actual answers. And you know, as long as you minded your manners, you were accepted as a member of that kind of elite fraternity. And that ran until AOL arrived, and the great democratization of the internet began, the term of art for this is the September that never ended. People still write about it. People still mourn the time when there was a bubble world that worked, the way that I've described. Next thing that comes along is the beginning of the internet becoming a real thing for real people. And this is the arrival of credit card processing online. The cypherpunks, you know, originally this bunch of political radicals that wanted to change the world with cryptography, plug in enough cryptography that you could securely process a credit card, fairly securely. What comes out of this is the phase that I will call the internet of shopping. And the internet of shopping is 20 years of shopping. Starts in the late 90s, runs right up until the present, will continue to run. And essentially, the internet of shopping has more or less the political impact of the Sears Roebuck catalogue. Right? It doesn't change a damn thing. It's not intended to change a damn thing. It's intended to facilitate and smooth out pre-existing consumer behaviours for ordinary people, whatever that means. Right? Shoppers, the kind of people who build malls for. And building an internet that works for the kind of people that live in university libraries gives you one kind of an internet. Building an internet for works the kind of people that frequent shopping malls recreationally gives you another kind of an internet. Facebook is a digital mall. Amazon is a digital mall. Right? Facebook is kind of the food court where people are hanging around and talking about and showing off their new shoes and all the rest of this stuff. You know, Amazon is the shopping part of the mall, and it's a very efficient shopping machine. It's really, really good at not feeling like you're shopping if you just want to get in and do something, and feeling a lot like you're shopping if you want to browse until your ears fall off. You know, these are effective services. They give people what they want. Unfortunately, people want a bunch of things that, frankly, if you put all those desires together, are not great. The internet shopping gives us the same kind of world, right, as the real world. And right now we can do a lot better than the real world. The real world is not an aspiration. Right? You know, the internet's becoming like the real place, and the real place is not doing so well. So, third phase, the cypherpunks come back to that. Right? Right, we're gonna fix it this time. Boom! Bitcoin. And Bitcoin takes the kind of cypherpunk utopianism that preceded the invention of HTTPS and credit card processing online and puts it right back front and center. We're going to have an internet in which there is total freedom. Right? The software will be super hard to install, so only a cognitive and political elite will be able to use it. We'll talk about abstruse politics as if they were completely real and self-transparent, and we'll load the entire libertarian utopian world model online one more time and see where we get. And this is Bitcoin, right? They get started about 10 years ago. Bitcoin acquires value because American libertarians spend it to life, right? It's the political will of American libertarians that makes Bitcoin worth anything. They start the cycle, right? Julian Assange gets his credit card processing blocked. They can no longer send money to WikiLeaks. People start buying Bitcoin and sending it to WikiLeaks, and suddenly WikiLeaks has access to cash again. Right? That's more or less where Bitcoin really began to get done into the real world as an actual thing. Now, since then, it's been roughly 10 years, right? From the inception of Bitcoin, I think we did the first initial discussions in 2008, really gets moving 2012. Here we are today, Bitcoin pushing $2,000 value. Ethereum, which is a kind of post-Bitcoin project, which I project managed the release for, did a lot of the early communications work for, currently trading at about $90 a coin. Right? Bitcoin's total market cap is at around $30 or $40 billion. Ethereum is about $8 or $9 billion. These things are, by any standards, extraordinarily successful startups, albeit they're not really startups in the form you expect. Now, what has happened? The banks have arrived in enormous force. Ooh, Bitcoin. Well, let's just get rid of all that politics stuff and figure out how we can keep these ultra-efficient transactions. We like that. All this, you know, libertarian stuff, we know we're not so keen on that. You said anarcho-capitalism? Well, we like the capitalism part, but the anarcho-capitalism. Right? And the rapid, you know, splitting of the political from the technological is accelerating, and at this point seems inevitable. Right? The entire rebranding of Bitcoin as blockchain has been an enormous separation of the political, the ideological from the technical. The rapid move to regulate and normalize, and I've taken part in that process, I did the blockchain strategy for government to buy, went out there, had one set of meetings 2 weeks later, it was all unexpected. No doubt at all, we are in a position where we're beginning to get the real world to follow the templates that we've set. But the price for this appears to be that the blockchain, Bitcoin, Ethereum nexus, whatever you want to call that, is rapidly mainstreaming into the transaction processing systems of the world. It's becoming part of the real world. And in the same way that the original cypherpunk vision winds up domesticated as HTTPS, it's looking increasingly likely that this second or third generation cypherpunk vision about, you know, end-to-end utopian interconnectedness with no interference or censorship, an internet of, you know, free speech equals free spending, is rapidly being pulled into this configuration where the banks take the majority of the benefit from those technologies. I think the writing is on the wall for the currencies. Right? I would find it very surprising if 5 years from now Bitcoin was regularized into the financial systems around the world as money. Because, as we all know, the Silk Road and local Bitcoins were an enormously effective machine for essentially selling drugs on the internet by taking cash at bars. Right? We can't get away from the fact that an enormous amount of money from really sketchy sources went into Bitcoin and is still sloshing around as part of that $1 billion. So what I want to basically question is, where do we think this shift is going? Because over about 20 years, 25 years, generation after generation after generation after generation of cypherpunks have gone up to Batman. Right? The first time I wrote a piece of software that was intended to get right up the nose of the government was 1997. Right? Been at this a while. I don't talk about it very much, but I do things. And I'm not sure that it's working. I'm really not sure that it's working. Capitalism's enormous ability to pick out the useful parts of these kind of political innovations and recapture the entire space, I think we're hugely underestimating our opponents. I think that I want to basically slow the show down and really have a think about what's happened so that as we go into the next round of this, maybe we don't make the same mistakes we've been making for 20 years. So would there be a Facebook and an Amazon and all the rest of that stuff, Google, if you couldn't process credit cards on the internet? Answer, no. I'm not saying that we would still be back there with our utopian internet of ideas that nothing would touch, was unsmirched by commerce. Back in the early days, does anyone remember the conversations about whether there would ever be like businesses on the web? Right? Remember that? A discussion about whether there would ever be a commercial internet. Wow, we were naive, right? I remember that. My God, what happened? Right? Now, we're in this position where people are wondering, you know, what's going to happen to Bitcoin? What's going to happen to Ethereum? Are we going to wind up with this kind of utopian end-to-end pure digital thing? Or are we going to wind up with state and corporate capture of those technologies, resulting in the next phase of the real worldening of the internet? Now, I know a lot of people that are very utopian. This time it's different, right? This time we're going to win. We're going to take over the world. It's all going to be fantastic. The SEC will never descend on all the people who are doing ICOs. Bitcoin will never be gone after with RICO for money laundering. Right? The banks and the governments will definitely not recapture this space, and we will not wind up in an environment where if you've got a smart contract attached to your bank account, it will automatically debit your phone every time you see it. See what I'm saying? So I think that we need to accept that there's a very high probability of total recapture of the cryptographic space by the conventional powers that be. I think that at the 5-year mark or the 10-year mark, it is much more likely that you will see a world where just about everything that you interact with demands to be paid, and you swipe your phone or your fingerprint for more or less all interactions, than it is that you'll see a world which is run by anonymous digital cash. And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. I keep having this conversation with serious Bitcoin people, saying, look, what do you think would have happened in Russia during the fall of the Soviet Union if the oligarchy had had access to Bitcoin? They could simply asset strip the country, and that money would never have been recoverable, it would never have been traceable, you would not even know who the oligarchs were. Some guy driving down the street in a Fiat Panda turns out to have you know, $48 billion sitting on a credit card. So I'm not sure that the needs of the ordinary people during that period of freefall would have been better served by a cryptocurrency environment than a cash environment. You could argue that ordinary people could use Bitcoin to, you know, do little bits of black market stuff or get money back and forth from their cousin in New York, but you could equally well argue that their life would have been much worse because it would have simply differentially empowered the oligarchy. And I think that we have to seriously consider whether we have thought out all the way to the end of this kind of technological thing. Right? Because, you know, we're not in a position where the technicians enable something and then there's no response. The technicians take their blow, and then reality takes a lot while to catch up, and then it counterpunches. And, you know, we're in this backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, where the technical class continue to try and create utopia, because this is what engineers do. The world has made problems, we solve the problems of the world, and this encountered the people who don't see the world as a set of problems to be solved, only a set of advantages to be accumulated. Right? There is a certain we're all in it together property of mind, which is very common among the engineering and the technical class, which is entirely not present in the government class. Right? The rulers do not see the world as a set of problems to be solved, only as a set of advantages to be accumulated. So here we are, pumping the world full of a new set of cryptography. We have the blockchain, which enables extremely durable permanent records. We have all the new stuff which is being done with namespaces, which will give us permanent addressability for objects and presumably for people. We've got the smart contract, which is a completely unforgiving and inhuman way of implementing agreements. Right? I'm not liking the idea of a world in which we have self-driving cars owned by Uber or, God forbid, owned by themselves, which you pay in anonymous digital cash to get you around a city. I think that this world is going to be really cold and hard and unforgiving. There is going to be no pleading with the taxi driver to get you home at 5 in the morning because, you know, you've lost the track of all your friends, you lost your wallet, you have no money, and you're very afraid you'll lose the phone. Right? That world evaporates, and what we're left with is cash on the barrelhead, you're going to go where you're not going to go, and it's going to be a machine that does the negotiating. Right? Human flexibility that we've come to rely on as part of our societies is likely to be one of the first victims of this increasing mechanization. And this is before we start having artificial intelligences making some of the poor decisions. So, you know, what I'm basically mapping here is a landscape of anxiety. Right? I look at this stuff and I'm watching how quickly the real world is moving to recapture this kind of territory. Right? I was at the European Parliament a couple of days ago and I did a half hour basically teaching a room full of MEPs and MEPs researchers, you know, what blockchains are and what we might need to think about in terms of regulating or not regulating. And it's very clear that these are smart people. You know, MEPs are perfectly comfortable talking about the halting problem in the context of Ethereum gas. This is remarkable. But at no point does the political vision of a world which is genuinely peer-to-peer enter these people's minds as a possibility. Right? The thing that we think is real, because we can see it relatively clearly in our heads, to them does not register as a potential future. So when we say peer-to-peer, end-to-end, you know, everything can connect to everything else without interference, you don't really need to regulate that stuff, we'll just kind of take care of it ourselves, that basically lands as one day the world will be filled with pork shop trees. Right? It doesn't sound like any kind of reality that exists inside of the political mindset or inside of political space. So all of that stuff immediately gets blocked out and discounted, and then they just look at the technology and says, okay, here are the set of advantages we're trying to accrue, this technology maps to that advantage, we'll have it, this technology over here, we can't see any way that gives us advantage, right? We'll block that and we'll have it. Does this sort of make sense as a model in the world? You know, I mean, I've been working hard on this, and man, it's grim out there. So let me take this down to the map and then build up again where I think there's some legitimate reason for hope. So the prospect that we're going into is that we'll see the existing sort of capitalist, post-capitalist, hyper-capitalist, post-democratic world that we're heading into. And what will come out of that is a kind of robotic DM, right? That the endless complaining processes of trying to make the bureaucracy behave will be largely automated away by artificial intelligences that will certainly never give you the money, but will certainly keep you going through the process, right? Institutions will become less and less flexible. The kind of people that are currently making their living with tax loopholes will make their living in enormously sophisticated anonymous digital cash schemes or similar, where assets that don't even have names and are not even within the scope of the tax authority to conceive of will be used to, you know, reliably earn billions of dollars without anybody putting taxation on it. So the prospect is that we're simply going to take the existing situation and amplify and empower the mess that we're in, because we have yet to figure out an effective way of getting the kind of nerd culture social values that generate the artifacts to maintain control of the artifacts once they interface with the real world. So what's happening is that we keep making these enormous breakthroughs in terms of the way that the world could work, and then these enormous breakthroughs are taken by the political class and used to maintain the existing framework more efficiently. And at some point, you have to say, this is not that different from the bomb team turning around to the American government and say, look, we've invented the weapon to end all wars, could we please end all wars? And the American government just goes, guys are so naive, please, you don't understand it. Back to it. And this is where we are. So my response to this, right, was to get out of the technical class, if I can. Right? And so I decided that I was going to go and start a venture capital firm. Right? I wasn't going to go and do another big crypto project. I was going to see whether I could crack the money thing head on, so that there would be the ability to invest in innovation in the areas that I thought were productive. Some of that would be ruthless capitalism to make sure the damn fund worked. Some of that would be entrepreneurial long-shotism on the possibility that you could get companies that could change fundamental things about how humans interact with each other. 10% of human beings right now are born couples who are matched by a robot. I think we could do better than that. That doesn't necessarily mean a higher number. So, what I've observed from that step is the more I put on the money guy hat and look at the world from the perspective of capital rather than from the perspective of talent, the more I begin to understand how you wind up this endless sequence of technical capture. How is it that we keep inventing these amazing things and they wind up getting turned into product? And the answer is really, really, really simple, right? The world is a really hard place, right? It's a really hard place. There is a kind of awareness of how difficult the world really is present in the people that work with money and power, which is not present in other areas. And you see the same thing, by the way, with the military. You think that the military are the people that really understand where the bodies are buried, but the military still believe in concepts like patriotism, which is why they show up for work anymore. Right? The military are very much like the technical class in that they are motivated by dreams, which have very little relationship with the reality that their masters create for them. The technical class basically believe that they're solely building Star Trek. The military believe that they're still having a war that will end all wars. In actual fact, neither of these things is true. Because what happens is that the money class and the power class, and remember I am tempted to change sentence, exists in a world where there is permanent winning and losing. Right? The stuff that Ira talked about before, the non-zero-sum nature of the world, the people that deal with non-zero-sum nature of the world, the people that deal with winning and losing with absolute scarcity, are the politicians and the capital. So there's a specialized skill in our society which is playing zero-sum games for keeps and playing them to win. And what happens is that in any kind of utopian world model, whether it's patriotism or basically kind of Star Trek futurism, you wind up at a point where the utopian world model is incompatible with the world's actual scarce artifacts. And you wind up shelling out to a different category of reality to handle that problem. Okay, we've just discovered this is going wrong, we need to get somebody to fix it, we need another 50 grand, right? And at that point, you're in the non-zero-sum game again, because you need the resources to get the person in to solve the problem that you now have, And that money could solve company A's problem, company B's problem, or company C's problem, but it can't be in three places at once. The people that we expect to make those decisions are the people that wind up being perceived as the ruling class. In actual fact, they're the people who make a decision when there is an inadequate amount of resources to carry everybody, who gets thrown off the boat. And this is basically the suggestion that capitalism is triage. The power class is a triage class. When there's not enough resource to go around, who gets it and who doesn't get it is the decision that these guys are fundamentally about making. Whereas the kind of utopian class stuff which is coming out of nerd culture is largely about how to make sure that we don't wind up in a zero-sum reality. So tribe A, the technical tribe, are like, okay, if we get the engineering right, we can make sure there are no more non-zero-sum games. We can make sure that we have enough to provide for everybody's basic needs, and then on top of that, we can build quality of life. And that is a basic value set. It's more or less universal in the technical class. Right? Very much like doctors, we have a definite kind of unspoken set of ethics, which are best represented right now by free software, but which have been around in their various forms for a really long time. You come over to the class that handles the money, the power, and scarcity. For them, this world doesn't look realistic. They can't imagine a world with so little scarcity that that stuff would be real. Right? You look at a world which is filled with Android phones. Something like, what, 70-80% of the world's phones run free software? Everybody still acts as if open source is somebody else's patron. Total inability to relate to reality as it is. But this is still the world. So, over on the money and power side of the fence, the question is, all of the utopian dreams that the technical class create, what can currently be profited from in the hard, not zero-sum world? And it's that set of decisions, looking at the world where, you know, they really are very aware of where the blood is on the streets. Right? Looking at that world, and moving back to the technical world, and attempting to figure out what little pieces you can pull out and use, is basically the job that we've outsourced to the money guys. Right? The questions about is Bitcoin a threat or a menace are being asked because somebody's finally done something really big and bad in public using Bitcoin. They've been doing stuff that was really big and bad in private using Bitcoin for years. I don't hear Bitcoin people taking that seriously. Well, you know, okay, it's anonymous digital cash you could send around the world in the blink of an eye. But, you know, that's not going to make the world any worse than it was already. The governments are worse than the mafias. Are they really? Really? I've spent a lot of time dealing with the government. I've never really dealt with the mafia, but from what I hear, the mafia are a lot worse. And this is the fundamental lack of grip on reality to which, to some degree, the technical class are bred. So, what I want to suggest here is that it's probably too late to say the blockchain as an instrument of fundamental political transformation in a direction that we actually want. I might be wrong about that. It may be that it somehow manages to slide through and we manage to find some utopian path between a hell realm made with anonymous digital cash and assassination markets and a hell realm made of completely traceable everything where the machines make all of our decisions. It might be that we find the kind of humane middle route there, and I'm certainly trying for that. I have some ideas about how you might get there, but you know, I'm struggling in vain to some degree. Let's make sure that on the next round of this game, we're no longer naive. Right? I can't think of a better way forward than an absolute recapitulation and recapture of the space of real politics by the engineering class. Right? Dealing with money, dealing with power, dealing with authority, dealing with rules, becoming harder and faster than the governance class. You can see a little bit of this, believe it or not, in the archetype of the programmer. Right? When I was, you know, 25, the vast majority of nerds were physically weak. They didn't take care of their bodies, they had no remarkable characteristics. About 10 years ago in California, they invented programmers, you know, suddenly you've got nerds who are still nerds, that they figured out that you could apply scientific approaches to building the physique of Conan the Barbarian, and they're doing it. So they're sitting there, still nerdy as hell, head down to the code, and I looked at that, and people were horrified. And I looked at that, and I was like, okay, we're evolving. We're actually beginning to adapt to the environment that we're in. The technical class is capable of learning, which is something the political class seems to be incapable of doing on a pretty lavish scale. That's why we still have a world without nuclear weapons. I thought that would be a bit of a wake-up call. So, what I'm basically suggesting is this. If we want the world not to be a continuous series of us inventing utopias and other people hijacking them and turning them into more of the same crap that we've got now, we have to be in a position where we're not going to let anybody hijack our utopias. And this means direct displacement of the political class through conflict. We get into fights with the political class and we win. For example, Mark Zuckerberg appears to be preparing a run for President of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. He's on a 50-state tour where he's going to places like car plants in Michigan and riveting on doors. Yeah. Right? Now that's really, really aggressive. He's a 30-year-old guy sitting on top of an enormous amount of money and the world's best media manipulation, framing a presidential run against Donald Trump. Right? This looks like a nerd stepping up to play. Right? Elon Musk doing basically the work that, you know, the United Nations should be doing if the United Nations actually represented the interests of all humans on Earth in a realistic way. He's doing the work that it ought to take a world government to do, more or less as an individual. Right? No wonder the guy has godlike status. He might as well be a god. Right? Give it about 500 years, there'll be a statue of him, Richard Stallman, and then a very big pyramid with Elon Musk on top of it. And that's about all anybody will remember from the time before the AIs arrived. So what does it look like for us to actually start figuring out how to become capable of solving the problems that we currently outsource to the money class and the power class? Right? This is a hard question. The less wrong people are doing a lot of work on that. The people that are reviving Stoicism are doing a lot of work on that. The people that are reading political theory, not the kind of utopian libertarian stuff, but the hardcore stuff about how you get and maintain power bases in democracies. Right? Lawrence Lessig keeps going out there with the nerd social fallacies and just get walloped. Okay, this is how we can fix America. Whack! We don't want America fixed. So either Lessig or the next Lessig might come back with a much more aggressive approach, which is simply about taking scalps and destroying the people that have done worse in the legislature. Right? There are all kinds of things that we basically act as if we are too good for, and generally speaking, try not to involve ourselves in, because this is the icky political stuff. This is the power stuff, this is the money stuff, this is the emotional stuff. This is the territoriality, this is the commerce. But right now, all that I'm seeing is that I'm standing in the middle of another one of these transformative messes, where the stuff that we've worked for is rapidly being recaptured. I am fighting to try and preserve as much of that potential as I can to try and negotiate a situation where we reach a settlement with the powers that be rather than simply have them banned. But in the process of that, I'm giving away the vast majority of the utopian territory that we held 2 years ago. And very few other people in the environment that I'm in are in a position where they're taking any degree of responsibility for those negotiations. They're hanging on to the utopian vision that this time it will be different, Bitcoin will eventually be worth $100,000, it will be accepted everywhere in the world, and the governments will not stop it. Right? They're hanging on to the vision that a world which is governed end-to-end by smart contracts will be a fairer world for everybody, and not simply the people that have assets, with a vastly lower cost of guarding and protecting the assets, renting them to a world of people with no assets. Right? And without that political realism, without that fundamental grip on the nature of reality, and about the willingness to manifest the personality characteristics necessary to function in that world, I don't see how we don't have this happen again with virtual reality and AI, augmented reality, all the other big technologies that are coming around the pike in the next 10 years. They're all going to go through the initial explosion of utopianism, where we imagine that these are enabling technologies for Star Trek, and then the capture, at the end of which we wind up with another round of capitalism, but this time it's rentable realities. Right? And it's not as simple as open source. It's not about believing that we can stay in the non-scarce utopian mindset and in some way that will carry it through because we'll finally accumulate enough resources that we can cure politics by ending scarcity, which was, by the way, the Buckminster Fuller approach. Right? The design science revolution. Right? Turns out, Every time we get build a larger base of assets, the political class discover new kinds of scarcity to foist upon the world. So I don't think until we figure out how to get fully and firmly and finally on top of these structures, we're going to get out of this mess. Right? It's going to require us to get into a position where we are the people making the scarcity decisions. Not pretending that the world will never come to that stuff, but to become the people that make those decisions. To be the people that handle the money and handle the power while remaining loyal to the kind of utopian technocratic vision that we all hold, but to actually get our hands dirty in the governance of the world as the world is, not as we want the world to be. Thank you.